Weekly World 136.
This rectilineal world, this is the world of what we will call the artificial, as distinct from the natural. When we live in a world like that, we begin to have ourselves bamboozled by it. You begin to think that reality is this sort of straightened out situation that we all have to live in. And you don't remember that reality is precisely the wiggly world.
It's never straight up and down.
Wiggly World. Hello, friends. Let's see if I remember how to do this thing. What do I do? Blow into this? First, let me say, friends, a Wiggly World may contain language that is not work safe, is what we consider it here. Usually, I like to jump on Free Ball Friday. Last Friday, so raring to go with the Wiggly World show. But I had to do mom taxi, had to take my mom to different places of food shopping and things. She wrecked her car. She's all right, but the car is a loss, so she needs to get a new car, and we're going to search for that. But she had to go to the eye doctor because she had another cataract surgery thing, lens put in there, so had to take her to the doctor there, and then to AAA, and it all culminated with quite the acme, the zenith of the mom taxi was, of course, taking her to the bank to deposit the $5 check from Staples department store. That's right. So that happened. So now we are stuck with Titty Twizzlin' Tuesday. I don't know how prepared I am. I don't think I am quite prepared. I don't have all my nuts in one basket. I was raring to go on Friday. You would have been in for a treat. However, now we have to settle for the, we call it the snack mix. Snack mix is, of course, the remnants, what is swept up from the floors of snack companies when they make many snacks like cheese doodles and bugle doodles and, of course, the mouse doodles. We opened up with Alan Watts there. I had considered just playing the song by Devo, which, by the way, Gerald V. Casales, of course, gave me the complete thumbs up. He gave me the high sign to allow me to use that as the Wiggly World opening theme. And I've been using it for the past 700, 800, 900 years that I've been doing the show. And so that's good. So I thought I'd let Alan Watts, maybe I'll just put Alan Watts on, put a record on, and be a much more entertaining show, number one. And number two, it wouldn't hurt as much in my cubbyhole. But I thank you very much for allowing me to vibrate your earballs bones on this fine Titty Twizzlin' Tuesday. If this is your first time listening to Wiggly World, welcome. Welcome, I am Wiggly, a voice for the hundreds. At 45 years of age, I feel as original, passionate, and outrageous in my craft as I did at 14. I consider that craft to be observing large and varied amounts of media, concepts, superstitions, and fluff. And then I spit it all out, hopefully in an entertaining way. I'm not trying to entertain. I'm not trying to put on a big show, a big production, although I would love to. This one's more of a conversational podcast. I try to do something special with the other shows I'm involved with, which now is We Talk Games. But it used to be the Chikara Podcast, A Go-Go. I used to do a pro wrestling show, which got some write-ups in magazines across the in England. That's where I got it right up. But, you know, it's been inspirational for other people, all the different types of shows I was involved with. But now, it's really just a Wiggly World. The last one I did was about 9 decades ago. But here I am right now in your earballs, which I'm very pleased to be. By the way, I will not actually be speaking to you today. What it will be is a representation of my voice, which is vibrating the diaphragm in my microphone, being changed into bits and bits and bits and bits, and then spit out to you, vibrating the diaphragm in your earphones and then the diaphragms in your vagines. At age 14, I was praised by my senior acquaintances that I was some type of a sage to them, a wise old soul. Today, I would just be satisfied to be considered a critical and irrational thinker. And the only sage, I did smoke the sage. Don't know me. I've never put the doobie to my lips. I've never even had the marijuana going around in me and the... like that type of thing. I never did heroin. I never shot the morphine between my toes or any such things like that there. Then there, I don't even take the insulin. So, but if I was prescribed insulin, I probably would. But I've never done, I never did drugs. I never got in with that crowd. I was straight edge punk all the way through. I always thought that I had decisions to make, or what if I was posed. Is that the right word? What if I was approached with a decision to make and I was, you know, incapacitated in mind, not of a clear head? I wanted to be able to make those decisions correctly. So I sort of always stayed away from that. I didn't have a drink till I was 31 or 32, somewhere around there, I believe. And so here I am today. Whether by choice or ignorance, I've never feared showing my ass. I'll most likely show my ass on today's episode. Although you won't be able to see it, you'll be able to hear it. I don't mind being proved incorrect or drastically changing my opinion or perspective when confronted with new evidence. Addendum to last show, believe me, I do know the difference between melatonin, which is naturally produced in your brain when you're ready to go sleepy time, and melanin, which is the gamma level that you have in your skin corpuscles-y things. So I do know the difference between that, but yet when I spoke about melanin, I kept saying melatonin. And this is what happens when it's a one-way conversation. I'm having a conversation with you. It's just that you cannot shout back through your iPod tunes radio, although you're most likely yelling at it when I constantly make these type of grammatical mistakes and vernacularly incorrectitudes-nesses. I don't know why I'm speaking in words that don't exist and incorrect conjugations, but that's what's happening today. So expect more of that, and this is what you should expect, these branching segues leading to nowhere and making me forget exactly what my original point was. But I do know the difference between these things, and unfortunately, you are not there to correct me as I continue saying them, and hopefully it doesn't bother you too much. But, you know, what I'm trying to say is I believed a lot of crazy shit in my life, but I never stopped questioning and exploring the beliefs that I held. What else about my person for the new listener? I was raised on 1970s television. That was pretty much my mama and papa. My mom, you know, she did the best that she could. And my father committed suicide when I was, 12? So I had to grow up quick, and then my mom had some strokes, and, you know, didn't spend a lot of time going out with the gang after that all started occurring. I've won some art contests that other people entered me in. I love to create music, and I believe that I understand what it means to be a performer. I lived in a converted chicken coop for far longer than I would like to admit, probably around 20 years. And I think that's enough for you to know about me before I get started. It really probably doesn't tell you very much. I breathe. I eat. Sometimes a turd around, make big toilet. But my life's completely open and expressed in one manner or another on the many podcasts I've created since 2005. So it's out there if you care to plod through any of that. And another thing that's been keeping me from doing episodes has, well, it's, you know, it's mostly just been time. I sit down to do one. Who knows? Sometimes I sit here with headphones on for like 45 minutes, and I said like 2 minutes of things. And it's kind of wacky. So I need a longer stretch of time, even far longer than it takes for me to record one of these. I don't go back and edit a Wiggly World podcast like I do some of my other shows. My one other show that I do, I should say, that we talk games. But the one thing that was preventing me from doing episodes, right now, I don't know if you can hear the low rumble. There's a guy that parks his... I live in a city, city-ish, and there's a guy that parks his semi on the street, across the street. I don't understand that. You're not allowed to park a semi on the city street, and yet he does. So sometimes he lets his motor idle for... I don't know what he's doing. Now we got another interruption there with the did-did-did-did-did. I don't know what that is, a CB or something. But one thing that was going on, which I couldn't do anything, it was like 3 or 4 days of this outside contractor coating our sewer pipes. Instead of replacing pipes and doing patchwork and all this other things, this company that got won a contracting bid from, I don't even know, Virginia or somewhere, Maryland, they came and... blow heat on your turd pipes, and then they shoot foam and plastics on it. They do plastics on the inside and coat it with something, and on the outside they put foam rubber and insulation and who the hell knows, spun glass. I'm not sure. They're blowing pipes. I don't know what's going on, but they were out in front of my house nonstop. They must not, some of the people there must not have had hotels, and they just lived in these trailers, these sort of like a moving van, like a long moving van. And I went out there to take my garbage out last Monday, and I really wanted to, or last Tuesday, to pick up my garbage can. Wait, last Monday night. Yeah, last Monday night. Because I wanted to try to do a Wiggly World on Tuesday, and that didn't happen as well. So I go out there to dump my trash down on a curb, and let me back up a little bit, and this won't take long. They had a giant task force doing this, many, many of these moving vans. And they were all set up sort of like in intersections. Majority of this stuff was happening at intersections. And normally when you go through and, PennDOT, which is all, you don't have PennDOT unless you live in Pennsylvania, but the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, you go and you have flag people and flag people say, come, you stop, you go at a traffic. There's nobody doing anything at these traffic lights except standing there and looking down a manhole cover. I should say a person hole cover, I guess, to be politically correct. So there's people stand. They're not. No one has a flag. No one's saying, come on, don't go. There's just some places you would turn down a road and you'd get to the end of the road. And you could only go right because you couldn't do anything else. And there's no markings. Like, don't go down this street, local traffic only, something like that. Nothing. It was so frustrating, these how they conducted their business here. But it was funny because normally, I don't know how, I think it's the same all over the world. Even if you go to sub-Saharan Africa, I think, if there's a road construction crew, you automatically know that they listen to country music and there's some type of, redneck country folk. I don't know why. They're usually overweight, country music listening, chaw tobacco in their left side and a cigar out the right side. But these were all folks from the hood. These were some hardcore gangsta toilet plastic people, steam cleaners. It was really something. The urban outfitters, the pants, hanging down to their knees and just hanging out and nothing really going on. And I thought, that's kind of odd. But then when I went to take down my garbage on a Monday, I couldn't believe it, because on these you know, very ugly, decorated, like I said, moving van type of things. They're just giant white things, and they have their logo on a side. It's called, like, Insulux or something, you know. Very, very Wonder Bread, very, very plain vanilla ice cream. But this giant moving van had these shiny rims on with freaking like 4-inch spikes sticking out of the inside of rims, like, you know, you'd see in the like the Grease movie when those spikes come out. But they had these spikes sticking around a rim on this just bizarre. But they just let their engines idle for overnight, and the generators and everything. It was very, very discomforting. I had a hard time going to sleep and just constantly hearing those ELFs, extremely low frequencies. It was just very disconcerting and upsetting, and definitely would have bled through. So I couldn't do that. There was also, there's been big trouble in my tech job, and I'd love to go into tech talk because no one cares about tech talk. But, you know, I'd like to tell you how you can get off-the-shelf serial ATA drives, modern ones, to work with your Intel-based Xserve. However, I really don't want to go on that. It's going to take far too long and lose the remaining three listeners that are still on in the earbuds. Let's just say, make sure that you get the Western Digital Serial ATAs and that they have the legacy jumper connections on the back. For some reason, the Western Digital 1 terabyte serial ATAs had jumper connectors on the back, and thankfully they did. I mean, jumpers sort of went the way of the dodo when serial ATA came out, because now you don't have to put it a slave, a master, or, you know, cable select or anything like that, because serial ATA takes care of that. Well, the Apple hardware, if you have the Intel-based one, the G5 will still work, but the Intel-based one will say, I don't even see this drive. I don't know anything. I'm dumb. But I did the second from the left jumper. Fortunately, I had some old jumper pins from some older drives. Put it on the second to the left, and guess what? Format it, rate it, and now I'm back in business. But my main file server took a poop, as well as other things happening with our no more internal web development. So I had to jump in on PHP stuff, which I got to tell you, I have no idea what I'm doing. But I do have a good technical understanding. I'm a very good technician, and that's probably why I am so inquisitive and what I believe to be a rational thinker. It's because I know how to take apart a claim, a situation, a statement, an emergency, a problem, an issue, and start breaking it in half, and then breaking that in half, and breaking it in half. It's sort of all about knowing the right questions to ask. But let me tell you, I scoured the internet trying to find out if anyone was ever able to get off-the-shelf serial ATA drives, certain ones, to work with this the Apple Intel Xserve, and there were no resolutions. It really used to. I used to have off-the-market ones in there, and they worked. But the newer ones, it's like, "F you, buddy! Buy our $1,000 gimmicks that won't be available very much longer from Apple, because as soon as support runs out for those, you know, forget it. Good luck." But that worked out for me. And if you're in tech talk, nobody cares about tech talk. Poop poopy doo. Atheists, Christians fight over Texas nativity scene. WTKR TV3. I decided that instead of trying to read through piles and piles of literature on today's show, I hoped to just read other people's work off the internet, out of books, tea leaves, my text messages, and then this way I could comment on those and hopefully avoid any type of copyright infringement. But, you know, like I said, this is a show for the hundreds, so here we go, my hundreds. WTKR TV3, Atheist Christians Fight Over Texas Nativity Scene. Thousands gathered in Texas to support a religious display that's come under attack. By the thousands, the faithful arrived in Athens Town Square for what many called a holy war. A holy war. Wouldn't that be nice if the only wars, the only holy wars ever since Constantine, the only holy wars would be someone gathering maybe around your house or something and saying, I don't want to see these mannequins. Holy war. My goodness. Follow News Channel 3 on Facebook, by the way. Up to 5,000 people rallied. Wow, 5,000 people for mannequins. Can you imagine that you can get five? I wish I could get 5,000 people together for like even a good cause. 5,000 people rallied around a Christmas nativity scene in front of the Henderson County Courthouse, blasting a Wisconsin atheist group's efforts to get it removed. Our fight, our relentlessness, and our courage. Everything is bigger in Texas. For many here, though, this is about far more than decorations. It's about what they feel is a continued attack on their Christian faith. Pastor Nathan Lorick. It's time for us to stand together and protect the very principles that made this nation great from its birth. Said Pastor Nathan Lorick, who, remember, is a church pastor, not a historian of American history, that's for sure. It's time for us to stand together and protect the very principles, the principles that made this nation great from its birth. Because it's weird. When I think about the principles that we fought the Revolutionary War for, I thought that was to make our nation free from a sovereignty, religious-based, over-monarchy type of gimmick. I could be wrong! You know, what do I know? I believe he went on to say this. We've become so busy that our lives that we've become so busy with our lives that we've forgotten our first love. It's not my first love, and I didn't forget. I remembered, and I became bitter, resembling more church service than protest, it says here. Now, here comes Pastor Derek Rogers. What we need Christians is to stand and say, Jesus Christ is the only way. He's a rhymer, as a matter of fact. He was big into D&D. What we need Christians is to stand and say, Jesus Christ is the only way. Well, I don't know why anyone would be protesting about that sentiment being paid for by tax dollars from, a secular society. It just doesn't make any sense. Jesus Christ is the only way. Everybody knows Jesus Christ is in the Bible, Jesus Christ. Thousands prayed in the town square, the name of Jesus Christ, in quotes for some reason. The display is critics. Boy, who wrote this? An internet kid? The display's critics. Oh, that is right. It is possessive. Okay. I'm wrong. Here's my ass, everyone. The display's critics feel the scene is offensive and believe church should be separated from government. The Freedom From Religion Foundation has even threatened to sue. Other towns have scrubbed religion from their displays. Yet Henderson County shows no sign of cracking down. Help take a bite out of religion. We're cracking. SWAT. Get SWAT in here. Any religion. Shoot. Non-lethal. A clear display of its faith. Here comes Donna Stutz. Never expected God to send a message from Athens, but that's what he's doing. He's sending a message. Well, I guess if you believe that, you know, a fallen star is going to hit the earth, as it says, the Bible says stars were falling to the earth, you know, star. The sun is a star. And if the sun fell into the earth, you wouldn't be writing about it. If you believe about all washing the feet all the time and the significance of that and the significance of what words were even translated into the English word feet, which you might be schlong-prized. How many verses are dedicated to what type of drapes God wants in his tent, the interior decorating requirements, curtain colors, the upholstery, the fabric choices, the beadwork, all that business. And I guess that is how God sends his message from Athens about, you know, mannequins. Now, I think that what this article is missing is that, and doesn't really portray here, is it's the same thing that the only problem I have with it, which is what probably other people have a problem with it, is that this is on the taxpayer land. This is put on by the city. The city, your taxpayer money. I'm sure there's some Republicans in these 5,000 people that want to keep, you know, not raise your taxes, of course. Keep the government out of your small government, all that type of business. So I'm sure, why wouldn't it's? These are being paid for. I pay taxes, okay, and pretty much people in America pay taxes anywhere on the globe. And we have traditions that go on. I mean, there's Christmas celebrations up and down the street. That's for sure. I decorate. But I decorate now. I didn't decorate when I was a Christian because I knew that none of this, absolutely nothing, except perhaps a midnight mass might be, which is kind of shaky either. None of that is particularly intrinsic at all to Christianity. From wreaths to trees to mistletoe to any poinsettias, anything that you could think of, giving gifts, the whole, you know, worship of the sun thing, the festival of lights, gives it away the most. You know, Kwanzaa and Hanukkah, it says it right in the title. This is what it is. It's a festival of lights. It's the equinox. It's the the garbage truck backing up outside. Winter solstice, you know, and all the gods that were prevalent at the time and all those type of sentiments. I knew as a Christian that these things, well, after I researched things, but as I wasn't a preteen, you know, I knew that they didn't have anything to do with December 25th, and I knew that didn't have anything to do with Jesus. So I didn't celebrate Christmas. I didn't celebrate until I started really reading, knowing what I knew about the Christmas celebrations. And then coming on and being a Christian and then deciding to try to find out what the Bible really says, and then reading the Bible, of course, then I got out of Christianity because I read it, and then I started to embrace those traditions for what they really were. Now, do I believe that Dionysus was born out of Zeus's thigh, and that he was the original born-again person, the twice-born god, and you know, all the other Egyptian mythologies, and Isis and Osiris and all this other things. I don't believe that these were people who ever really existed, or gods existed, or half-gods, or man-gods like Jesus, or things like this, or Hercules. But I love that mythology. I love tradition. I'm not above tradition, but I am for exposing superstition. So I would have no problem. I have a couple crosses, as a matter of fact. I thought they were onks, but I have a few crosses, and I have no problem even displaying those. But I don't know if I would, you know, put them on the outside of my house, because right now, while I consider a lot of Christian sentiment to be hate speech, I honestly do, at this time, it's still not superstition with a large majority, as it being that Christianity is the number one world religion, and then Islam, Muslim is second largest, and then what do we go into? Hinduism, Buddhism, I'm not sure. But I don't recall, and I really don't keep track of it, and I'm not a bean counter on that area. And here's one of those segues I was mentioning. I really went out on a riff. But we decorate here in Easton. Some of my tax dollars goes to lighting this giant candle, a candle ceremony in the center circle. They turn this pointy monument thing into a big candle, and then some lucky person, a kid or whatever, that had some type of community impact achievement, they get to, you know, throw the switch and light her up. And when I lived in Bethlehem, we paid for trees that would go on each telephone pole and things like this. So, I realize that's happening, and I can understand that. But this is, the creche is a real icon of a religious belief. And it's not a secular type of thing. It is, like this person says, we have to say that Jesus Christ is the only way and things like this. So it is a little bit more representative of a religion, even though no matter the fact that it's all completely taken from other stories, a lot of it stealing from itself, of course, in Midrash, and not even accurate, and then taking the mother and child predates Christianity. Everything about it predates Christianity. Signs in the sky, virgin births, kings, people trying to kill the baby. These things that are repeated in the Bible itself, which, as I mentioned, with Midrash, and then just complete sentiment from things that preceded it, from its contemporary mythologies and whatnot. So I can completely understand it, and I don't know why these 5,000 folks that are protesting the protesters can't understand that this it shouldn't be what their taxpayer dollars go towards. If they want to pay, put in a fund for their nativity scene and have it displayed on a church or in their yard or in some type of private, even a public park that's privately owned or something of that nature, I can completely understand that, as long as people that don't believe in this stuff aren't having to pay for it. Now, there's all types of levels. There's people that are atheists, there's people that are non-theists or non-Christian even, that it's bothersome just to go through this whole ordeal of crowded shopping centers, and all the negative types of things that come with the Christmas holiday. But I find it to be a complete commercial type of happening now. I have no problem buying into the commercial aspects of it and making it really, about Santa and the Christmas tree and decorations and things like this. And I love it and I enjoy it. And our celebrations are getting larger and larger, especially with a house now. We finally had a larger tree. I don't know, it's like 6.5 feet, maybe 7 feet tree. I haven't had that, geez, holy mackerel, since I was like 12, maybe I put up the tree a few more times after my father committed suicide on December 27th. So, Merry Christmas. I'm sure that went into my dislike of Christmas as well. And I blame Jesus for that. Baby Jesus fucking put the hex on him. And, you know, I had some great memories that Christmas. It just was so... Boy, if you want to talk about the sweet and with the sour of life, I hadn't planned on talking about that. I really don't plan on talking about anything. And anything can happen on Titty Twizzlin' Tuesdays. That year, I remember my dad coming over. We put up the tree. We put up a real tree that time, though. We didn't get the artificial. I don't know if we had the artificial by then or not. But anyway... I remember him playing, I remember the stereo being on, I remember him singing along with the Christmas carols, and one of my favorite songs that he sung was, "Go to hell, go to hell, go to hell, go to hell." So that's a great memory of my dad trying to steady the top of the tree up on a ladder with the putts. We had a putts under it. Singing vulgar variations of the Christmas. I have a couple of vulgar ones. I can't think of them right now, though. And that year, my mom and dad were, I guess they started, they were living separately not too many months before. They were going to get a divorce. And I remember that Christmas, I got toys that I could not believe I got. Like, you know, my childhood was all right. Every now and then I get a toy. Sometimes at Christmas I have two other really fun memories of Christmas, opening gifts. One was I got these dinosaur models. I got a woolly mammoth, triceratops. I wanted ankylosaurus. That was always my favorite. I might have got ankylosaurus, but then I got the La Brea tar pits as well, which was cool because that came with like a saber-toothed tiger and some birds that were drowning and stuff. I think I had a pterodactyl. I mean, that was great. That was a great year when I got those models, and they were snapped together. So come on. I was a kid. And then one year, man, it was so awesome. I got the Planet of the Apes. You know, they brought out figures that were based on a television show. I got the Planet of the Apes, and I got the treehouse for Planet Apes, and I got the village playset. Now it was like if you saw the Batmobile or if you saw the Star Trek figurines, they were these plastic like suitcases, and they would expand and be a playset. Well, I got the village for the Planet Apes, and I got the treehouse, and that was awesome. I didn't get the horse. I really wanted the one horse for one evil militant gorilla fella. But I later did get a third party knockoff horse that he actually had a remote control. But I'm trying to think. Did he ride in it like a car? Did it have like a hole in the horse that he sat inside of? Or did he actually have a saddle? I can't remember, but it would walk a few steps and then fall over. It was wired, of course, back then. But those were some good ones. But this Christmas, I got the Ricochet Racer with Spider-Man and Captain America, which I still have down under Sloppy Joe's bar. And it still works. I still shoot it across the bar every now and then. And I got another thing, Spider-Man, which was the Spider-Man and the Fly racetrack, which was a really cool slot car racer. I don't know how cool it would be to slot car enthusiasts, because you didn't assemble any track. It was a plastic formed playset, and so you just open the box and the whole track was inside the bottom of the box. And, I had like a cityscape or something, mountains, I don't remember what. But then you plugged in the Go gimmicks. And this sounds familiar. I don't know if I talked about it a little bit. Anyway, I probably did. I talk about everything, I think, over and over. But, I had some very good, but that was, and then on the 27th, 2 days later, bang, he shoots himself. And so there goes that. Sweet with the sour, boy. That was the best toy Christmas I ever had. And then just horrible, horrible. And, that's why I talk about suicide a lot and try to help folks out. And who had to live with that? Not my dad. He's fucking dead. So, you know, his worrying stopped with my poppy and my uncle and in the other room making coffee. That's who had to live with that. I feel the worst for my poor poppy. And I don't think my other relatives even know about that story. Well, my uncle does, because he was there. But I mean, Jesus, you know, that's who had to live with that. My mom, she fucking is a mess, and I had to live with that. The person doing it doesn't have to live with it anymore. They don't have any. I have shit to worry about. It just goes down to the people next to the line. For many years, I wrote songs about it. You know, what choice? What choice do I have with such a horrific thing? My buddy, Jesus Christ, he had it worse than me. He saw his mother commit suicide, and his father pickled himself to death. And then his grandma died, and then I don't know how much longer his grandpa. I mean, he lost his entire family in not too long of a time span, and he was a kid like me. So, you know, you are responsible for yourself, and your life is your own. You can do with it what you will. Never feel boxed in, but Jesus, at least, you know, talk to people about it. Talk to the people that are going to be stuck with more than what you are under when you think that this is the only solution. Just talk to the people that are going to have to live with that for the rest of their lives. And like I said, whatever you're going through, they're going to go through much more and more guilt and more everything else. If you feel like you're a danger to yourself or the others, you call 911 or whatever the emergency number is in your particular place on this earth. If you feel like you're going to hurt yourself or others, call 911. Another buddy of mine, freaking, you know, just on the legal and illegal drugs and smashed his car, recidivist, smashed his car with a passenger, both weren't wearing seatbelts, smashed into construction signs, wrecked his car and hospital and everything else, and just, you know, don't do that. Don't do that. You are an idiot to do that. So don't be an idiot. Don't be a jerk all the time. Jerk's one thing, a complete idiot, asshole, irresponsible douchebag is another. I'd rather you be a jerk, but don't be an idiot. All right. So, God's great plan for his tent. Let's this whole, you know, just knowing what you believe. I wanted to talk about. Let's just get some things out of the way here. I don't know. I have a couple things up. I don't even know what I'm going to read. Reading from the books of internet about the councils in charge of voting on the books of the Christian Bible. I pulled up a lot of things. You know, you can go to Wikipedia and just look at the development of the New Testament canon. Some of this stuff is going to point you in the right directions of going through antiquity, going through the early church, and it'll give you some, if nothing else, it'll give you some good ideas of some of the main players like Origen and Justin Martyr, even people that are considered or there's an inkling to know that they probably wrote most of the Pauline gospel, which is really what started it all as far as the appeal of the mythical Jesus Christ, a completely non-human, non-historical character, and that would be Marcion. And I know that Robert M. Price knows a lot about Marcion and likes to talk about him as well. But one thing that you have to consider, of course, when you're talking about Wikipedia is that surely there are a lot of apologists that also add to this open wiki of encyclopedia. So there's a lot of things that are trying to say that, you know, first century is when a lot of this came about. But there's no doubt that the, as it says in here, for the Orthodox, the recognition of these writings as authoritative, and talking about the canons of the New Testament, the writings as authoritative was formalized in the Second Council of Trullan in 692. So see, we're almost 1,000 years. Well, that's not right. This is almost 700 years. It's very easy for me to add on a few hundred years, but let's think about it. How many of us were alive in 1901? Show of hands. So now we're in 2012. So that's 110, 111 years, depending on when it was in 1901. So that's a span of, we'll just round it off to 100 years. Now, how many of us were, so there's not many of us that were around. How many of us, probably, how many of us were around 1,000 years ago? In 900 years ago, let's go back to that, to the year 1001. So 1,110 years ago. How many of us were around 1,000 years ago in the year 1001? Not many. Not many. In fact, none. So you have to realize 100 years is 10, 1,000 years is 10 100 years. And then 10 100 years over again is 2,000 years ago, and that's when the Jesus person was supposed to be walking around. So the Second Council of Trullan is when they settled on the orthodoxy of the New Testament, which is 692 years after this whole thing was supposed to go down. And as it mentions in here, Justin Martyr, in the mid-2nd century, so in the year 100, between 100 and 200, in the mid-2nd century, mentions memoirs of the apostles as being read on Sunday alongside the writings of the prophets. A four-gospel canon, the Tetramorph, was asserted by Irenaeus in circa 180. So once again, end of second century, who refers to it directly. So these are the first times we're hearing that there's actually something put together, the Pauline epistles, you know what I mean? I don't know any scholar that would believe that Paul wrote all of his manuscripts, or that the apostles that were said to, that are penned under their names, were written entirely by those folks. And especially in any type of translation scenario, and I mean, most of the Old Testament, we only have from the Septuagint. I've read in places that a lot of the Old Testament wasn't put together even later than what the New Testament was put together, as far as agreed upon and concise and cohesive. A lot of that didn't exist. Now, I could be completely wrong there, but I know that Jesus, the character of Jesus in the New Testament, even quotes from the Greek version of the Torah. So that's kind of unusual for Jesus to do, too, because translation is, by necessity, interpretation. So no matter how literal you want to get, there are just some barriers intrinsic to language that has to lend itself to be an interpretation instead of a direct translation. And we can go back and we can look at some of the things, perhaps in its original Hebrew. Perhaps in the Greek, perhaps in the I want to say Akkadian. And then I'd be wrong, because that's what the Sumerians spoke. Boy, I hate the tip of the tongues. Aramaic. Aramaic. And then, you know, we could try to get a better understanding of what's being said here. But I want to read. So that's a little bit of it. That's when things started. I don't know why I jumped ahead to this council. Evidently, it was something I wanted to talk about. I have it here on my iPad. And once again, I don't. This is from a book on the internet. It starts out like the Wikipedia, but I don't think I got it from Wikipedia. It says, in his Easter letter of 367, Athanasius. Now, remember that before this, we had Constantine, and Constantine tried to pull together some manuscripts to be distributed and penned out. I don't know how many he made, 100 or 200 or something like this. But we're going beyond that, and Constantine was very instrumental in getting this to be adopted as the state religion, and then you know, Christianity became the mandated religion. You could be put to death if you did not believe in Christianity. Now, what I often get this from even Jehovah's Witnesses: why has it survived this long? Well, because at some points in history, you'd be dead if you didn't believe it. So you believed. It was actually a matter of life and death. But there's a lot of other reasons, and as I point out to the people that question me about why it survived so long, why is Monday Monday? Why is Thursday Thursday? Why is Saturday Saturnalia Day? Why is Sunday the Sun's Day? Why is March Mars? Why, you know, we use a lot of ancient mythology in our everyday lives. We only do Christ Mass once a year, but we do Thor's Day every damn week, you know? And there was something else about, what was it again? Oh, Easter. Easter. And the biggest Christian holiday, Easter, the most important one, one that is even recognized by, has to be recognized, I think, by every Christian, or sect that wants to call themselves Christian, is Easter, the death of their Savior, the thing that made Jesus, why it's so important for God to give his only son to be murdered, which is just that's the best he could think of. And Almighty God, that's the best he could come up with. Kill my son, and then you can be saved through him dying. Well, it wasn't much of a death. He came back to life in 3 days. That's not even so good. You know what I mean? It's not even a great... How about like maybe 100 years he was dead and then he came back? Even that's not being dead, though, you know? But that's the best God could come up with. Kill my son. There you go. That'll do it. That's a ticket. Wow. He's dumb. So, where was I? But Easter is named Easter after Easter, the whore of heaven. It's just amazing. It's one of the few other gods mentioned in the Bible, Astarte, and Astor, whichever you want to call her. It's just it's mind boggling that's such a. It's like right from the start, you're damned. In this, right from the start, you're in trouble. It's sort of like reading Genesis. You're in trouble out the gate. It starts with, plurality, Elohim, the plural of Eloah. You're talking about gods, and then you're talking about having light before the sun, and the stars being different than the sun, bats being the same as birds. Bats are birds, and every other kind of moronic thing. Trees growing without light. Okay. And so in his Easter letter of 367, Athanasius, how come I can say it in my head? Athanasius, I'm going to just go, Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, gave a list of exactly the same books that would become the New Testament canon, and he used the phrase being canonized in regards to them. Athanasius also included the book of Baruch and the letter of Jeremiah in his Bible. He also eliminated the book of Esther from his Bible, the African Synod of Hippo in 393, approved the New Testament as it stands today, together with the Septuagint books. A discussion that was repeated by councils at, and I know this one as well, Carthage, in 397 and 419. These councils were under the authority of St. Augustine, who regarded the canon as already closed. Pope Damasus I, Council of Rome in 382, if the Decretum Gallicanum is correctly associated with it, issued a biblical canon identical to that mentioned above, or if not, the list is at least a 6th century compilation. Likewise, Damasus, I like to call him Dumasus, commissioning of the Latin Vulgate edition of the Bible, circa 383, was instrumental in the fixation of the canon in the West. In 405, Pope Innocent the First sent, what a bastard he was, he wasn't very innocent, Pope Innocent the First sent a list of the sacred books to a Gallic bishop, Excerpius of Toulouse. When these bishops and councils spoke on the matter, however, they were not defining something new, but instead were ratifying what had already become in the mind of the church. So, I think the important thing to just, let me say, thus from the 4th century there existed unanimity in the West concerning the New Testament canon as it is today. So 4th century, we're drop dead date right there. And the 5th century, and by the 5th century, the East, with a few exceptions, had come to accept the book of Revelations, see, that wasn't in the original, and thus had come into harmony on the matter of the canon, because they thought that the book of Revelation was just so fucked up. Some acid trip, you know, of John of Revelation. So, the important thing to remember here, and there were councils even before, but the Bible is voted on by councils or single people. And even before we get to these councils, voting on what is the Word of God, voting on the nature of Jesus. Was he historical? Is he the Son of God? Is he magical? Does he drink blood? No, you drink his blood. That's right. You know, all these other, the sacraments, the Council of Nicaea, the Nicene Creed, that business. These are things that are up for vote. Just like you go and pull the toilet plunger for the elections, you go in here and vote on what is out of God's mouth. And they go back and forth. And books are removed and books are put back in. And now we're getting Latin editions. So now we're in yet another translation of it. But even before these councils, even in the Old Testament, stating that the lies of the scribe, those inscribing it, in the days that these people are saying that these other stories happen, they're saying that people are writing down that it's a lies. And then, of course, in the New Testament, Paul is, you know, writing letters back and forth on, you know, what would Jesus think about this? What would Jesus think about that? It's just Paul just pulling out of his ass what he thinks, you know, Jesus would say. It's not even inspired. He's just writing, I don't know if what I should think about this or that. What's your opinion on this? And even then, you know, the different writing styles of the apostles, Matthew and Mark and Luke, saying that those other people are they're fighting amongst themselves. The apostles saying that this guy's not anti-Semitic enough. This guy's doing away with the Torah, which not one word, not one apostrophe, not one anything will be stricken, not obeyed until we see Jesus return and things like this. So it's really something. And these are things that, you know, are these WTKR-TV folks, these 5,000 protesters, do they even care about this? I would care if this was the most important thing to believe. As they say here, our first love. Don't we want to know what we love? I hope to go over the Chikara theme 2011. By the way, in this episode too, just try to break it down a little bit of fun things that happened in between making it and releasing it. And it's always a lot of fun for me, and it's lighter. So, you know, I'll try to end with that. I hope I get to that. It's getting late already. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, in the past few days. Is environment an excuse for behavior? Is that legitimate? And, you know, it's that whole nurture or nature type of thing. So is it a legitimate excuse for your behavior to be blamed on your environment, the effect of environment on human development? Now, some of us, like myself, may have a hard time accepting the excuse or reasoning behind development being a combination of genetics and environment. I had a very hard time with this. Not that I didn't believe it to some extent, but I am a person that maybe early on, it's hard to know exactly when, realized that I wasn't being pushed around by my immediate environment. I knew that I had control and I had choices, and I was responsible for my actions. And it was the results. There was very few times that my hands were tied. Very few times of crisis where I could say, you made me do this or that. And now they teach us an EQ, and I don't know what else. There might be in some woo-woo books and stuff like that. But I realized that I was responsible for my actions. Not the devil made me do it, not any of that type of other bullshit. So I had a hard time fully getting behind or thinking that that you couldn't change even if your environment was very bad, because I was an example of it. I came from a very abusive household. So there's a lot of violence, and a lot of yelling and a lot of passive aggressiveness and all that. And I did not want to do that at all, you know. Nor did I. What is the meaning of environment? As I mentioned, I grew up in my immediate environment was abusive. Fortunately, it made me want to rebel against that behavior because I felt it was morally inconsiderate and wrong. You know, I thought it was wrong. Plus, I'm sure many other factors that contributed to that as well, but I don't want to, you know, it kind of sounds like I'm a rebel, you know, but I did, like every teenager, I think you rebel against your parents, you rebel against authority and things like this. So I know that there's a lot of other things that contribute to that as well, but surely I can take credit for my actions as I also take responsibility for those same actions. But in reflecting, I believe it was also because I had access to other information. I knew there were other options out there, either in reality or just figments of my imagination. I thought I knew that there were other options out there. Like, okay, I could drink and take drugs and smoke cigarettes and do all these other things. Or I could do something interesting and, you know, swing around in a tree like a monkey and, you know, jump on these giant tree canopies that were made in the cornfields around me. There was some really neat vine work. And these vines would grow together in such a way that you could climb up a high tree and then jump into these vine hatchwork. I don't know what you call that when things are intertwined, but you could jump on it like a trampoline. And it was really cool until, you know, of course, you jumped on it so many times it broke. But I knew that there were other things out there for me, like drawing or, riding my bicycle or doing other types of things. Well, I finally gave it a thought, and it was actually, I actually backward engineered it, like I do a lot of other things. But I backward engineered while I was reflecting on a much larger topic. And I understood the concept of environment. It just finally dawned on me. It has a big tie-in with the topics that we've explored before, dealing with the problems of free will by an all-powerful God. Not knowing that there are choices outside of this set due to the inability to access that information, or like in most religions today, acceptance without question. That's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. That's the way, granny thought, grandpap thought, great granny thought, great grandpap thought, and that's just the way it is. You don't question it. I also call this Mama Told Me So science, in that big movie blockbuster by what's his name, the clear eyes guy, him, Win Ben Stein's Money, in his great movie that he came out with. I remember seeing him on a religious program talking about his movie. What was that called? Jesus, I can't think of anything. Incredulous. That's the wrong one. Expelled. And I remember sitting on this, 700 club or whatever it is. Praise the Lord, PTL club. And he was saying, when I was a kid, my parents told me that, God created people, and that's just the way it was. And you didn't question it. But I don't want to talk about Ferris Bueller. The effect of the environment on a person. But now I'm talking about free thought. Free will, rather. The excuse or the reasons that I get from apologists or even from the witnesses that came here, from anybody, any Christian that tells me, about our free will and we have the ability to decide whether we want to do good or evil, and whether we want to come to Jesus, man, God's son, Yeshua, Hercules, or whatever, we have the ability to choose whether we want to go to them or not go to him and accept him in our hearts. Now, the first part about us making free will to do good or evil, we usually only make decisions based on the information that we know. That is to say, what we think are our options. That's our set. For example, are we going to order frozen cow tit juice? And the ice cream jerk tells us that we can choose between chocolate or vanilla. That's considered a set. But it's actually a subset of all of our knowledge. We know that there's also pistachio. So we could be a wise ass and ask for pistachio. We could also ask for plywood or foot or Band-Aid or you get the picture. Can ask for anything that we know that's in that much larger set. Anything within the limit of that much larger set. Our entire inventory of words we know, or even, you know, things that we can see in our mind that we might not know the name of, those are all things that we know. We can't ask for outside, we can't ask for things outside of our knowledge. Because we don't know that there is anything else. We can have an inkling that there probably is something beyond what we know, but we can't verbalize it, we can't conceive it, because it's beyond what we can conceive even. That's outside of our set. So an all-good Gog could make it so that evil, or what he considered evil or sinful, is just not an option in our grand set. The set of an all humanity, and why stop there? All creation. Certainly, I would think an all good God would not want the eternal suffering of all the cute little bunnies being torn apart by wolves and other predators, dying painful deaths in this murderous cycle of life. So it would be outside of our set to sin. We'd still completely have free choice because we'd, like now, not know that there are any other flavors of choices. In the second bit of free will concerning salvation, you know, we're told that God wants us to come to Him of our own choice. Now, as I see it, and for some reason... No one told the witnesses or no one told the Christians that shout at me at fairy rallies. Our choices are either to follow God or to burn eternally in the fires of hell. Now, I don't know about choices for you. I mean, choosing between chocolate and vanilla, that's a good choice. I consider that a choice. Choosing between burning eternally or not burning eternally, that's not really much of a choice. It's like handing an actor a script and saying, you can improvise. Improvise as much as you want, as long as you do everything and only what and how it is written exactly in this script, or I'll kill you. Hi, Mr. Peabody. Oh, and by the way, I won't just kill you. Might as well include the murder and torment of your entire family, because until God was reshaped into this personal deity, and back when he was still a tribal god of Israel, he would make your offspring suffer the penalty of your transgressions for 5-10 generations to come. Now, how can these politicians, how can these people, these 5,000 people complaining about mannequins, which I know they weren't, they were talking about things beyond that, thinking that there's some type of attack on their faith, as if your faith, you know... Is their faith so weak? Is their faith so weak that questioning their beliefs just would make the whole thing unravel, the whole thing fall apart? As Alan Watts says, without this big papa watching, they'd go out and rape their grandma. But how can these politicians run on a platforms of being Jesus-loving Christians, and I'm a Christian and I love Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior? How can they run on these platforms without even considering these questions or knowing what they believe? How can they not see that this is no choice? As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. That's from John 3:14. Now, John is the fella that tied all of Paul's mythical... I don't mean mythical, mystic Christ. That's more what Paul is, completely mystical Christ. And he tied that in to the later historical Christ type of narratives, the Jesus that actually had a lineage, tied into the fathers, by the way. The genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brother. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, and whose mother was Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab is the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon is the father of Solomon, Salmon, and Salmon is the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, and Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David, and David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asa, and Asa the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Jerom, and Jerom the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amon, and Amon the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah, and his brother at the time was of the exile of Babylon. And after the exile of Babylon, Jenochiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abihud, and Abihud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Elihud, and Elihud the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Mathan, and Mathan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. The Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. So here's, that's the historicity they tried to breathe into, or marry. John married this mystical Christ, born of a virgin, and to this historical character who has a paternal lineage all the way back to having to be the son of David through the father. But God was his father, right? Why is his father the son of David through these 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 from David to the exile of Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah? So 14 times 3. How can he be their sons? He's not. Because it's going through the paternal, not the maternal, like it should have been, compared to some of the other gimmicks going on around that time. But John is the person that married this mystical to this historical character. And he is saying, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, etc., etc., the Son of Man will be lifted up, and whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. So he's saying that the serpent in the wilderness of Moses is real and part of this. New Testament Christians, born-again Christians, even the witnesses that came here, try to distance themselves in some manner. Whether it's just to, out of ignorance, to brush it under the carpet, or blatantly try to distance themselves from it and say that it has no bearing. The people that didn't want the Torah, the people that didn't want the Septuagint to be a part of the New Testament. Some of the church fathers that I just mentioned earlier. He's saying this is John, the most Jesus-y of the Jesus-ers in both historical and mythical and mystical, is saying that this is also true, the serpent in the wilderness. And I read about the serpent in the wilderness on last show. I like it so much, I feel like reading it again. Numbers 21:4-9. They traveled, they put the title on the bronze snake. They traveled, and I'll read from the NIV, the New International Version. They traveled from Mount Hor along the route of the Red Sea to go around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way. I'll tell you what, we're coming out of Egypt, okay? We're coming out of the exile. And nothing but complaining. Finally free from Pharaoh's gimmick here. The God of Israel, the only God, the only true God, the God of Israel, is leading his chosen people, because he plays favorites, he's leading his chosen people out of their slavery in Egypt. After this whole drama of hardening Pharaoh's heart so that Pharaoh wouldn't let him go, no matter the slaying of the firstborn and all that other stupid shit that that you believe an all-powerful God would be doing, instead of just freeing the people. How about just like zap, like, I mean, Genie of I Dream of Genie would have handled this better. It would have been over in a half-hour episode, you know what I mean? This is silly. Anyway, after all that drama, they're coming out of the Red Sea. And you know, God, Moses and his brother Aaron performed all these things that no one could do. Well, I take that back. The Pharaoh's magicians could do them all as well. Even such silly things as after Aaron and Moses turned all the water everywhere, even waters in vases into blood, then somehow the Pharaoh's magicians are able to do the same thing. Well, did the blood turn back into water and then they turned it back into blood again? I mean, where did they get the extra gimmicks? And then also the same thing with the frogs. Nothing but frogs, 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 and yet they're able to make frogs and lice and all these other things. More frogs? I don't know. So they're traveling, and the people that they just rescued grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food." Well, what food were they eating that they didn't have bread and water? I don't understand what they were eating. By the way, they didn't drink for... I can't remember now how long they didn't have a drink for. It was silly. You know, it was well over 4 months, which, you know, how can you survive without any type of water for that long? I think it was much longer, considerably longer. Anyway, the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke out against the Lord and said, and against you. Pray to that the Lord," and I believe this Lord is Elohim, Elohim, Elohim. And they're no matter what, they're impersonal references to God. "Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. Now, Here's an almighty God that saves you from things. And instead of just asking him for some food or praying for some food, you're complaining about things and thinking that this is going to get you somewhere. The Lord said to Moses, now here's almighty God talking to Lord. It's not almighty God, it's Lord, it's Elohim. It's one of the gods. Said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. Why bring arts and crafts Just, God, don't make the serpents to bite them. But if they look at a magic stick, then they're okay. Do you think Ralph Perry, what's his name, Rick Perry, ever read Numbers 21, 4 through 9? Probably not. But John says about him, the New Testament says, doesn't he look to find out what he's talking about? Moses lifting up the snake and stuff? Good crazy. Now, as you can see, we did quite a bit of segueing here. So somehow that thorny bush of thought relates to the effect of environment. Even though we live in a highly connected way with access to, I mean, the limits of collective human knowledge, there's very little. There's been some things I can't find by Googling and really digging down and searching and all time kinds of algorithms and things. But we have access to this. There still exists those who are affected by local environmental influences, either because they are innocently ignorant, willfully ignorant, or they're too weak to go against the norm. They're fearful to go against the norm. Or they just want to do the mother told me so science, or a variety, a combination of all these causes. But I now have a better understanding and a more compassion for environmental excuses or reasons for behavior. I understand now that it can be outside of a set of knowledge. Obviously, Rick Perry and the other folks and people that want to win by saying how Christian they are, obviously there's things outside of their Christian set that they are unaware of, like looking at a bronze snake to be saved from snakes that God sent to bite people when they said they wanted bread and water. Now, that might be out of their set of knowledge, but it definitely is not outside of the set of their Bible. It's right there. It's so close. It's so close. But for whatever reason, they don't know that. So I could really understand, environmental effects and not knowing that you can get out of that, not knowing that that should spur you to rebel against things that you don't want in your life. There just might be many other reasons that environment is so impactful on some folks. And very long way to get there, to that realization. In the last episode, I told you I wanted to look into a book. Jeez, that's how long ago this was. Wow. I'm sorry, folks. I wish I could have gotten down, sit down and do this. And right now I'm running out of time. I only have another hour to get my thoughts together and get it across. So I'm going to try to jump on the stick here. I mentioned a book that I was interested in called Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our I tried to tell you what the name of the book was, but it just says Race and Reality, where I was in the book. Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Bio, dot, dot, dot. So I went to the front of the book, and the cover is also truncated. So I had to go online. Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity. This is a book by Guy P. Harrison. And it is a very good book. Well, I'm going to say it's a very good book. something that interested me quite a while, because one of my first concise and expressed I don't want to say mission statements because that's so corny. But I guess it was a mission statement at the time, although, you know, I really never heard that word before. But a long time ago, I realized that I used to call it this, putting an end to prejudice by dealing with things on an individual level. And it was a methodology that I had never, not a methodology, an approach that I really had never heard spoken about as a way to put an end to racial prejudices. Now, you can't do away with prejudice because, you know, I'm partial to Tab over Diet Coke, and that means I'm prejudiced in some way against a Diet Coke. But I was speaking more towards a racial prejudice that occurs, negative racial prejudice. And of course, in the past 10, 15 years, we've had the genome projects, which you can trace your heritage through the different pathways, all leading back to Africa. And my lovely wife, Trapdoor Charmed, had that done. And spurred me to create this new colloquialism for our modern redneck to shout off their porch to passerbys of a darker color, why don't you all go back to where I came from? Mr. Peabody, what? Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, you know, we all know this. We come from the same heritage, but I really wanted to read this book because I thought, well, maybe there's going to be something I don't know. Maybe there's going to be a lot to talk about and a lot of different things. But if you get this book, and I recommend that you get it, But basically, in the first page or first two pages, he says something here. Biological anthropologists, for the most part, don't even refer to race anymore by that word. We call it human variation and human diversity. The reason that race is poor empirical description, of the patterns of differences that we encounter with our species. That is, if by race we agree to denote a fairly large, fairly homogeneous, and fairly discrete, in other words, a fairly natural division of the human species. Basically, every page, somewhere in it contains that biological anthropologists do not believe in race. And that's pretty much the entire book. I believe I can read the foreword without any problems. Yes, it says copyrighted material, but if you go to Amazon, you can read the first few pages, and it says, people who know don't believe in race. An important thing to know about the concept of race is that it is rejected by most of the people who know the most about human diversity. Anthropology is the study of humankind, our origins, our culture, our biology, our diversity, and our races, if they were real. So pretty much, biologically speaking, there are no races. Biologically speaking, we are all far too similar for there to be any distinction of race. Now, culturally, there are differences to race. And that's where this book helped me out. I was a person that also, back when I tried to understand, you know, what I meant by dealing with things on an individual level, I was also a person that saw it problematic to have, like, you know, heritage days and things like this. I've since changed my tune on that. But in its present state, I still think those celebrations of differences are, in a sense, detrimental. Only because this word has never gotten out. This has been known for quite some time. In 2007, the University of New Mexico hosted a symposium entitled "Race Reconciled: How Biological Anthropologists View Human Variation." It was attended by scientists specializing in genetics, forensic, bioarchaeology, paleontology, and human biology. In 2009, the American Journal of Physical Anthropology published a special issue on the symposium that contained several papers about race. The introduction to the issues listed five key points of agreement among the scientists. One of them in particular caught my eye. Race is not an accurate or productive way to describe human biological variation. But I remember reading somewhere in here, I think even as far back as, I want to say the 1960s, that Mr. Peabody, anthropologists, put an end to this, that there is no such thing, biologically speaking, as race. But when I came up with this idea of dealing with things on an individual level, I had mentioned, I had thought about that, I'm losing it, folks, I'm losing it. But, right, I think it's problematic to, have the Puerto Rican parade and things like this, because I've spoken about this before deeper, and I don't want to be superficial about this and say, no Puerto Rican parade. I think it's fine. But once again, I know that it is a cultural celebration. It is not a biological celebration. What this book has done was help me look at certain things in a better light. I think the biggest help I got from this book was that if you see someone and you think, if you see someone, you say, oh, well, that person looks different. They have this type of eyes. They have this type of nose. They have that type of mouth. They have this type of ears. They have this shade of skin. They have this type of hair. They are this type of height. They're this type of stature, whatever. If you take any one point or even a combination of points that you're trying to use to put people into a category, you're going to have a very impossible time to do that. Stereotypically, you have this, you have that. But if we look at our entire human culture, the entire Earth, the human race, right now even, not throughout history or what have you, let's say we try to line up everyone in a giant line around the globe based on skin color. Well, then you're going to have people that you might consider in your particular location, your geographical location, I should say. You're going to have people that you might consider black, or you might consider Hispanic, or you might, which isn't even a race, or what people call a race, I should say. It's very difficult to get used to this terminology. Or someone that you might consider white, or Asian, or South Sea Islander, any type of thing, Mongolian, whatever. You're not going to be able to pick them out and segment them by the color of someone's skin, because when you line up people, you're going to have this gradation that goes from very dark to, if you want to go to very light, I don't know, because there's all types of variations of colors within there, with reds and yellows and purples and even just looking at your own skin, there's so many tones in there. There's green going around. When I draw a face with crayons, I use all different types of crayons. I don't just use one shade of a color and then a darker version of that color. I use all different types of colors. But you can't go by skin tones, because there's going to be mixes of different things that you consider a race all along that giant gradation of colors of humanity. So then you say, okay, well, I want this color skin and this type of nose or something. You're going to have the same problem. You're going to have people with different types of noses within what you consider a subset of race or whatever, or of race. And so for everything, curly hair, straight hair, anything that you could think of, you're going to have problems trying to tie this on biology. And it's going to be more of a question of where in the world you might be from, the environmental effects of that location, and cultural differences. And to prove that that is the case, and something that I was not aware of, is that, let's say, the easiest thing to say is what we consider a black person. What we consider a black person in America is not the same, doesn't have the same parameters. If that person goes to, Brazil or some other place in the country, they might not consider that person black. Every place that you go around the globe, well, not every place, but different places around the world are going to have different scales, different measures as to what ethnicity parameters there are. In the United States, in the early days of building railroads, we didn't consider Irish people to be white. Irish was another race. So that was one thing I definitely got out of there. And it's a nice read. I didn't read it to necessarily enforce the things I already knew. But pretty much it boils down to, biologically speaking, there's no difference. There's no way to describe race or human variation. Or human variations. So it's a really good book, Race and Reality. I recommend it. And now, remember, there are cultural differences and even tribal differences. What I mean by tribe is your immediate community. So you can't go into just any old community and try to speak the lingo of that community, because people haven't been clued in that we are all the same biologically, and you will be treading on cultural differences, even immediate cultural differences. So, be wise to that, and hopefully we can spread the word that we actually all are the same biologically. There it is, a myth of race. The mythology, race is a mythology. It is a myth. It is a scam. It is a flim-flam. But there are cultural differences, and I want to embrace cultures. I want to embrace them as I stated earlier, with tradition. Tradition, cultural traditions, I'm all for. I'm all for learning about, and I think it's fun. And I think it's great as long as we approach these things with an open mind and with a rational open mind. Not as a God that I believe in promised me this land. That is when we must demand 0.0 tolerance and have their deity come and give them the land personally and, pay for our bus fare home to some other place. Don't kill people because you're standing up for your God. How weak is your pitiful God that he needs you, an ant compared to him, to go around with a machine gun or a bomb or whatever and be killing other people? Doesn't make any sense. It shows the utmost lack of faith when you think that you are the most faithful for being a coward and killing other people. It shows the utmost. That is the opposite of having faith. Having faith would mean you believe that your God will give to you what you are deserved. Or you could be like Jacob and play God and have conditions for God. Well, God, if I'm not going to get into it today. I want to talk about Jacob. I want to talk about a lot of other neat things, I think. I want to get into the Hellenistic period. I want to get into morality and how I'm thankful that I don't share the same morality as religions. But that'll take us into the third hour, I'm sure. I want to get more into Adonis. I want to get in more into Baal and more into El and how I began to talk about El Elyon. And you can even read about these things in the Old Testament. Speaking about the polytheism that my critics have said there is no polytheism in the Old Testament. Bullshit! It even gives you the different words for what is translated into God, from Elohim, which is plural, to Adonai, which is plural, and just, you know, lords and plural forms of this. And even something I just find completely amazing. Most Christians don't even know the name of their God, and this extends to all the Abrahamic religions, because we don't even know what the Tetragrammatron, the YHWH, how that should even be pronounced. We're not even sure if that is. I mean, they just old Torah just called him the name. You know, the name. El is used 238 times in the Bible. Adonai, 439 times. Elohim is used 2,600 times. And Elohim is plural, as is Adonai, I'm almost certain. Or maybe it's Eloah. I can't recall right now. It's too late in the show, and this is the time I start running out of gas. But God's name is really, I don't know. There's not very many people that call on the Tetragrammatron as his name, God's name, which we normally pronounce Yahweh, which is used 6,800 times in the Bible. Yet, we just call him generic God, you know, maybe with a capital G, maybe with a capital L for Lord. Doesn't really matter. You call a lot of people Lord. Lord is like saying Mister, you know, it's a little bit above that. But you know that, Lord and lasses and things like this. Yes, me Lord. You've heard all these types of things. But in Exodus 3:13 through 15, Moses says to God, to Elohim, look, if I go to the Israelites and if they say to me, what is his name, your God's name, and what am I to tell them? And God, Elohim, said to Moses, I am Yahweh, he who is. I am he who is. So his name is Yahweh. And that's who he tells. You know, he tells his people. There's a lot of pious fraud that goes on to make these, because God says, you know, I wasn't known by that name to Abraham, and I wasn't known by that name to Isaac, and I need to have things in front of me to speak on this intelligently. But there's a lot of pious fraud that goes on in translations, as I mentioned. Translation and interpretation, same. And I want to talk about that, and I will do that on a future episode of A Wiggly World. Now, another thing I was reflecting on is that, on a whole, I believe it's the obvious that separates us. It's the less obvious that unites us, and it unites us on a much deeper level. It honestly shows us as the same. And I'm not just talking about humans. The not so obvious of everything in our local environment and beyond our local environment all shows us as the same. And I mentioned about, I don't know, I was listening to playback on something. It might have been a very old episode. But it takes even from the incredibly small and then building up to, you know, single cells and then organs and then organelles and all the way up, organisms, and to us. And then stepping back and going back and lifting up and seeing this these smaller tribes, these smaller communities. There's an organism of some sort. And then going back, and then you see the whole of maybe your entire country, and that's an organism going up and up and up, and this whole thing. And you know, we always look into something that I gathered from Alan Watts, is that you cannot separate the object from the environment, and that's very important. That you can't describe the foreground without also having a background to display it against. You know, this there's an interaction, there's an entanglement between us and our environment, and it happens whether or not we want to pay attention to it or not, whether or not we are geocentric and have this ego, egotistical and self-centered. It's happening no matter whether we want to pay attention to it or not. So it goes beyond just that. If you give it a thought, you know, you don't even have to give it a full reflection or a meditation. And just saying that we share things in common with everything, at least on some level, that we all share certain, you know, molecules or atoms or things together, everyone would probably say, no, duh. And they make fun of me for being Captain Obvious or for being a goof. But who thinks of that entanglement? Who thinks of these low-level samenesses when the words are coming out of their mouths? Pride Fest, Heritage Day, someone moved into the neighborhood and is driving down property values because of, they fall into the Pantone meter area, and why someone is good with money or good with math. Where is that understanding then? Let's go deeper into the obvious. And I think there's levels of the obvious. and this all goes into process, because isn't that something we talk about, process, a lot on here as well? No points, just process. And that's sort of like lining up everyone by shades. It's not, there's no point. There's no one point. You can't see a point along here where, okay, unless it's completely ambiguous, you know, then you can draw a point, but it's completely ambiguous. It's as if it is a long process, and we're moving through time. So it is part of a process. When we look at a person, we see the obvious. How many colloquialisms refer to this? I don't know. You know, like, don't judge a book by its cover. Beauty's only skin deep. And I'm sure dozens more that I can't think of right now. But how true is it? How does it relate to our experience? And why didn't I make the correlation between my experiencing this and those sayings about the book and the beauty? Why did I never make that correlation? If you're a punk or you're a goth or you're wearing an Izod shirt or a superhero or a band name or a We Talk Game shirt, and you see someone else wearing that same cloth, what do you have in common with that person outside of wearing the same gear? I mean, unless you're in some type of cult camp with a hood over your head or a swastika carved into your forearm or something, probably not too much. Probably you might not have too much in common, unless it's a We Talk Game shirt and then you're part of a small community and you'll have a lot to talk about. But if you see someone else, you know, wearing the same cloth, you probably might have enough in common to get you talking. And then it's a talking that gets into the knot. Now you're getting closer. You're getting closer, brother. You're at least at a deeper part through the talking than an arranged marriage. And an aside on arranged marriages, this is still going on. Arranged marriages. You understand that there are people in our world today that are still outside of the set of understanding that love might be important for you to want to marry someone. There's no love to start in arranged marriage. Usually it has to come afterwards. But that doesn't mean that you're going to stay together. You might have just as good as probably have less divorce rate in an arranged marriage, mostly because it'll end in suicide or someone getting killed. But I mean, you know, you never know. That's not the point of it. The point of it is that there's still arranged marriages, you know. You might be a part of one. I don't know. Or were a part of one. But talking, communing, gets us past the superficial, maybe at least with humans. And humans are great at bending their experiences or outright lying to commune or talk or get us past the first layer. And on another side story, Gaiden! I will yell. I'm not going to yell. Gaiden! I'll yell that whenever I go on a tangent. If anyone ever asks you, well, what reason would they have for lying? Humans don't need a reason to lie. Sometimes we just lie. If we think about it, there's most likely an underlying reason for us to lie, like expediency or relating a story or to spin something to make it softer or more convenient or not as offensive. But most of the time, we don't even know why we lie and why a lie comes out. It's not only in reflection. Can we tie these reasons on for why we told a lie? Sometimes we forget. You know, sometimes we forget it's a lie because we've told it so many times. Sometimes we get confused. We can't even remember ourselves if something that you told as the truth was the truth or wasn't. We get crossed up between fantasy and factuality. But back to the talking part. We become more social, you know. And it's in the talking, it's in the socializing that we get a better understanding of the person. Now we're getting closer. Now we are getting a bit more towards the not so obvious. But even at that point, it's still a bit superficial. It's superficial and non-superficial. It's in that flux state. You know, like I said, there's no single point. Because the more you get to know somebody, the more you might not like them. So we're still at a point, at least we're at a better point. Now we're at the book by the cover and the look by the lover and the, you know, dribble by the dribbler. I don't know. But then we go deeper to the really not obvious. And of course, and this is where we're all the same. And it's kind of a lackluster ending. It's kind of anticlimactic to just say, and then we're all the same at the bottom because we're all made out of molecules and atoms and things like this there. And, you know, so we're all the same. So don't be a jerk and don't ignore me on Twitter because you're a movie star. You know, there's of course a lot more superficial things up above that are causing these gaps. But sort of, I'm trying to tie it all together and didn't expect to get here. But it's sort of interesting that we got here because it does tie up. It does tie together a lot of what we've been talking about here, as far as race goes, as far as beliefs go, as far as searching for things, as far as not taking things for granted, and definitely seeing everything as a process. Because even though we are, oh man, and it goes back to the Wiggles. It goes back to the Wiggles on the ocean. We all are a part of this entire wiggle, this entire vibration. And it's not just a wiggly world, it's a wiggly universe, and it's a wiggly everything. It's not even a wiggly world. Boy, it's even beyond that. And it's all part of a process. There's nothing that I can think of that is not a process. You know, we put points on time. We have natural occurring things like atomic clocks that have a decay that happens to tick down in a pattern. So you can say, well, there is a point in time, but it's not a point. It's a marker that we put on that, but what was going on around it was a process. And it itself is a part of a process. Even if the clock stops, then it is a part of a stopping process. And other parts of that process continue on, like it still being a clock and it's still clocking. Even if a clock doesn't count numbers, do we say it's no longer a clock? It's no longer a very good clock. But there's nothing I can think of that isn't part. Even the most sloth of internet ball sniffers, at their most laziest, just sitting in their own filth in their stinky desk chair with their gums rotting in their mouth, even that is a process. Because when their mom has to come and, you know, bleach their underwear and stuff like that. What about dirt? What about a rock? Well, I say, how many ways aren't those things active? How many ways aren't they a process? I can't tell you. They are fantastically active. They're part of our earth. The dirt, the rocks, the rocky sloths, what is it, 1,000 miles per hour rotation around our equator? However fast we're orbiting the center of the Milky Way, on top of that, the speed of our expanding universe. And from the fantastically macro to the incredibly small, the exchange of light energies, microwaves, which is sound, the entire spectrum, down to subatomic particles, rocks, dirt, lambs, locusts, frogs, boils, presidents, heartburn, video games, cantaloupe, Sally Struthers, you, me, them, everybody, all, not just the result of, not just an extension of, but actual bits of stars. Oh, be a fine girl, kiss my lips. Stars in us and us in stars. Where is the extension of the Bush tax breaks in all of their fuck that? How small is that? How scrawny the bourgeoisie? Non-existent. As close to nothing, as close to meaningless as you could get. What's important? Or better yet, what's so important? All and nothing at all. That woke me up a bit, I think. Now I'm back down. Speaking of WWE All-Stars for the next-gen consoles, your Wii, your PlayStation 3, your Xbox 360. I'm not going to talk about wrestling very much because I don't know anything about it anymore. But I do know about the WWE All-Stars because it dropped in price. And I thought, well, I'm going to play WWE All-Stars because it looks cartoony. It looks like an arcade game. And everything is very over the top. Everything is good. Now, it's all polygons, all polygonal. Everything is over the top. I just don't understand one thing. all the characters are drawn exaggerated, cartoony. They all look crazy, have these giant chins and really, you know, crazy muscular bodies and, you know, tiny, tiny waists and everything, and all crazy cartoony, but no love. Why didn't they make John Cena look cartoony? I don't understand this. Friends, it's that time for us to explore the household Wiggly household tips, tits and trips. One step bed making, ladies and gentlemen. You want to make things easier for yourself. You want to make your home a lot nicer to live in, not just when you're expecting company, but all year round. One step bed making. If you live alone, this might be a good tip for you. If you live with other people, you have to get them to join in on this. Here you go. Ready? You have a bed. You buy some of the finest linens for that bed. I say go out and splurge. $30 I save it a whole set. Now, you know, I don't know if you ever bought one of these bed set packages. Man, you can be like $200 or $300. Well, don't go for that. Go for a nice high thread count, though. It's always feels better. But an easy way to do one step bed making really is to get some nicer bedderies and make a very nice bed. Make it all up. Put your pillows and your things, and you tuck them all under, and hospital corners and all that business. Whatever you want to do, make it look nice. And then what you do is, when you're ready for bed, You get your other pillow that you have in a closet, and you get your other blanket that you have in a closet, preferably a big, heavy, thick quilt if it's winter, if it's summer, a sheet. And then you sleep on top of your made bed using your blanket. And when you get up, you fold your blanket and you put it back in your closet, and then your bed is made already underneath you. You only made your bed once in your life. You know, give it a washing every now and again. But that is a nice tip if you don't feel like making your bed every morning. You live a lifestyle where you just don't have that extra 2 minutes to make a bed. You can just make it once, make it look very nice, and then sleep on top of your bed. It's nice if you get, maybe don't get that real comfy, get the top of your, well, you can figure it out. Itchy ass. You have itchy ass, friends? Friends, do you suffer from itchy stink ball ass? Is your pucker hole red and scaly? Do you ever sing a song like this? Oh, I love my pinball. I love my pinball. Make a fart in your tootie hole. Friends, if you suffer from itchy ash, can't even do my joke right. It's too late in the show for this. If you suffer from itchy ass, try getting some of that Listerine. Now, get the gold stuff and don't buy the CVS knockoff, the Rite Aid version and stuff. Just spend the money and buy that golden, stink grandpa mouth Listerine. Get that and put it in what do you call this here? One of these Dixie cups that you brush your teeth with. Put in something like that. Or, if you live alone, I guess use the bottle. It's kind of gross. Who takes a mouthwash bottle and puts it in their ass? No one. No, get one of these paper cups or something. And when you're taking a shower, now make sure you're taking a shower and make sure you put some water back there. Because, this is Listerine. This isn't cut. This is pure. So when you're taking a shower, and just make like a cup hand back there, and then pour the Listerine in your cup hand, and give it a little that type of thing. Don't shove it up your hole. There you go. Do it like that. And then, you might have to do that once or twice, depending on your ass itch. And I think you'll be okay. Even hemorrhoids, you could do that. Help you out a little bit. I think it eases the discomfort. First time, it might be a little stingy. It eases the discomfort, and I found it to really... I haven't had itchy ass in I don't know how long. But if it comes back, just try it again. Washing dishes, friends. Washing dishes. Do you ever have a sink full of dishes? Friends, there is a solution to this. It's called... Well, now, if you live alone, it works really well. If you live with two people, it works really well as well. Now, this is only if you have a problem with tons of dishes in the dish in the sink. Get out, put away your good silverware, put away your good dishes, lock them up. Make it inconvenient for you to have to get to them. And then, unless you're a company, then you break them out. It's not that much of an inconvenience when you have company to do certain things like this. So lock up your good utensils, lock up your good dishes, and only have one plate per person, one bowl per person. Maybe if you have a salad bowl or something in a regular soup bowl, you can have that. One fork, one knife, one spoon, and one baby spoon. Only have enough dishes and utensils for you to be able to eat one meal. Same for the pots and pans, to make one meal. Step two, the end. Now, if you want to eat, you have to do your dishes. If you don't want to eat, then you only have one dish in there. So, problem solved. I had a very big problem with my one partner, where we would have sinks full of dishes, and I did that, and like I say, they have to go along with it, but we did that, and wow, you don't have a sink full of dishes anymore, and it really works, and it also gets you in a habit of washing your dishes like after you're done using them and putting them in a rag. It's not that hard, it's really not that hard, unless you make a giant meal, like a giant 5-6 course meal or something, and you have all these pots and pans, and things. Then it gets a little rough, but. If this is happening to you, give that a try. Also, save money. Save money by eating your clothes and washing your clothes while you take a shower. Just use laundry detergent to wash with and then dry yourself out by crawling in your oven while you bake your dinner. No, none of that is true. I don't know why I wrote down save money. I wrote down save money. It's a good idea, though. Save money. It's a great idea. One rule of thumb is if you have a credit card, and actually this is a better rule if you are just getting a credit card. If you're just getting a credit card, whatever amount you want to charge on there, only charge an amount on there that you can afford to pay 10-20%, well, to pay 20% on, that's the better idea, to pay 20% on every month. Like if you spend $1,000 on your credit card, make sure that you could pay $200 every month on that. Never spend more than what you are going to commit to put on that credit card under 20%. Now, if you have a credit card that has a higher interest rate than 20% because you're new to it or whatever, then you're going to be in trouble. You need to pay off on your credit card per month at least what it is, your interest rate plus some. Because you want to try to pay the credit card off relatively quickly. So if you could pay 20% of your credit card, then you should have it under control within a year, I would think. But then now again, my math escapes me. But always try to only spend as much on your credit card. Make that your hard limit. I can only afford $200 a month, so I will only ever charge up to $1,000, and then I'll put a hard limit on it. That's my ideas there. All right, now we're at the part of the show where I listen to this song. Let's see. Oh, wait a minute. Let's see here. There we go. That's it, right? All right. Your car is leaving 2011. Whoops. Okay. And yes. So, putting together Chikara theme... Is that coming through? Putting together Chikara theme 2011. I was told... This is codename Santo Gogo. I was asked to make a song based on the graphics for the Chikara podcast, which had been newly created, newly rechristened, that had a sort of lucha libre, luchador type. If you don't know who Chikara is, it's a pro wrestling organization that I was involved with for many, many years. Still am involved in the back end, mostly just trying to create some music every now and then. I don't do it as much as I'd like to be doing. And I co-created the Chikara podcast, Agogo, way back in the day. And now no longer am a part of that for the past about a year. So I was asked to create a song that looked like the graphic, and Mike said he wanted me to do it to sound like something, you know, in a Santo movie, if you remember Santo, the pro wrestling Mexican movies. He was sort of like a James Bond, except he would pro wrestle around with people and he wore a lucha mask and was Santo. And so I watched all the Santo movies I could. I even watched Mil Máscaras. I think Mil Máscaras was only in one. And there was this one scene, and everything I heard was jazz. It was all beatnik jazz for all the Santo movies. And Mil Máscaras, even when they were punching each other. In fact, I think the greatest example is Santo is fighting Blue Demon in their car. They're in a convertible. And the convertible's going around cliff edges, like, you know, 500-foot cliff ledges. And they're fighting in a car, and they're, like, heading into a tunnel, and they're driving all around. And they're fighting, they're punching each other. And it's like this, going, dink, down, gong, come on, jazzy, jazz, beatnik, jazz, oh, yeah, yeah, boo-ba-doo, beatnik, jazz, doobity, boobity, boobity. And so everything was beatnik jazz. So I thought about the high-flying antics of Chikara, and I thought, well, you know what? Beatnik jazz probably wouldn't be the best theme song for this high-flying, death-defying, very unique brand of professional wrestling. So once again, season 2008 Chikara theme song was the only... intro, except for this new 2011, was the only intro I didn't make video wise. It was made by college students, and was sort of had some 1980s looking graphics going on in the intro. So Mike told me he wanted something like Tron. Music like Tron. Well, Tron music was Journey. The soundtrack for Tron was Journey. So I knew, that's just rock and roll. So I realized that he wanted something that sounded like what Tron looked like. And for this one, for this song, I knew that he meant that he wanted something that sounded like what Santo movies looked like and what you should be hearing. So I thought, well, I'd try to take it in, but then again, I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I should just give him beatnik jazz. So I actually did want to try to marry the sound of the newer type of Mexican surf rock with still having a jazz something or another going along with it, and it finally settled on organ, a very simple organ riff over and over. So I have this acoustic guitar, and who knew that a $30 acoustic guitar would be a piece of crap? But I had this acoustic guitar, and it's acoustic electric, and that's why I picked it up. And it came with a carry bag. Let's see. Yeah, it sounds like nothing like hearing someone tune. Oh, my tuner went out of my tuner turned off. I'm not going to fart around now. So I tried to think, well, okay, so I'm going to make it this new modern, like within the past 10, 15 years, I guess, the resurgence of Mexican-style surf music. You know, like... that type of thing. But I couldn't... I don't know how to look up... I guess I should have looked up Kill Bill. Damn, I just thought of that. But I didn't know... You know, I didn't know any of these groups that did that. So I couldn't think of anybody that did like ding, 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 ding. I knew the Surfanes, you know, that was regular surf music. But I didn't really know how to put a Mexican flavor on it. And because I didn't know any Mexican riffs, it's something I just never did. And, you know, I'm used to like, I could do rock. But I never really tried to do any type of Mexican feel. So I just started riffing around. Like I'm just riffing. You know, I just started farting around. I said, well, how would I progress in a Mexican feel? So I started farting around, and I got it, I think. So here's the final bit. I'm not going to play the whole song. I'll just play the intro of how I came up with this. And then I go into surf, you know. And I actually wrote the bass part first, which is what I usually do. But I have my guitar on me now because I want to show you what I was up against in this. Now, an interesting part of this is that this beginning where I'm saying 1, 2, 3, 4 to myself. Okay, so that's actually me yelling into my... I'm yelling into my guitar. Hey, let me turn off my regular mic.
Okay. Okay. I said okay to the mic, but I didn't realize it's not on. So I don't know if you can hear me, but I'm yelling into my guitar.
Okay. I don't know. Hopefully you heard that, because I don't edit. But I just yelled, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4 into my guitar, because I was getting tired of recording the same lick over and over again, because I stink. One day I'll learn how to play guitar. But... this is what I settled upon, and I built upon this, and that's the funny bits about it. And then I do this solo, which I thought came out pretty good, but the funny thing about this is, I'll play this for you, this part for you now. I came up with this chorus, I guess. Me try to get this solo isolated. Oh, and there's another phone. All right, let's see here if I can get this happen. Oops. So I keep hitting pause on my recording I'm doing instead of pause on the Logic Studio here. So it's hard to believe that that's how much echo is on that solo when it's live. But here's the problem I had, and I didn't realize it. I was like, this sounds sour. So okay. That's the solo that starts out. So here's my E string on this $30 guitar. Now it's in perfect tune, E. And this is one of the scariest guitars to tune, and I don't know if I'll be able to show you. But here's E, and it's good. Now, when I go up to here to start the solo, so here's D, that's in tune. It's C sharp, that's almost in tune. It's a C sharp sharp. And then when I come down here, that's on a B string. Let me tune my B. Don't get scared. Okay, it's B. So I come down to the B string, and that is A sharp sharp instead of A. It's supposed to be A. And then this is supposed to be G, and that's way sharp. So my B string's in tune, but when I come up to G, it's way sharp, and A, sharp sharp, even though it's supposed to just be A. So I recorded my solos, and then I had to go back in and tune my strings to the proper tuning on that fretboard and do some overlays of that. So that's the funny bit on there. Ha ha! Not funny! Alright, now what I like to usually do is come in and show you... I thought this would be a lot more interesting than this. I think this is the second time it happened when I was trying to show some back scenes of some of the songs that I've written. I finally settled on this riff, and like I said, I wrote it with the bass first. Now, one of the unique things is I went back to how I used to compose songs on the old EPS 16 Plus. I did the drum track, the drum and the bass first, and usually I do that as well, but sometimes I'll just try to blow a beat in later. This time, I wanted to make sure that I had the drum sound I was looking for. I had something very specific in mind. I wanted to use a really big bass drum, really big swing bass drum. So I have an application called BFD 2, Big Fucking Drums 2, and I took a lot of time. I try to take a lot of time styling my drums on all my songs, but this time I took a very particular long amount of times, and it doesn't always work best for the song, but it works best for me and makes me happy. So I have I pretty much stuck with the Gretsch samples, and the drum is I can't remember what drum I have there. Aote Keplinger snare. That's what I did. So here's my big Gretsch drum there. Listen how loose that is. I love it. Just ringing in the new year. So I worked on those first. It's nice because it bleeds over into the snare. If I mute the snare, let's see. It's still vibrating it for some reason. I guess I can't. I guess I don't know what I'm doing. That's my problem. So, hiss. So I actually worked on getting a drum track together first. Just putting some... putting some ideas of drum patterns that I wanted to use on here. And so I drummed some myself, modified some myself, had a professional drummer create these MIDI sequences with the application. I don't even know him or her. So I took some of the application's examples and I put together an idea of how I wanted this gimmick to swing. And I laid them all out. I laid them all out in a big long line, and I tried not to repeat many or any of the patterns. There's subtle nuances, subtle differences in pretty much every one of these. I can't even think of what the hell you call a measures. Yeah. Boy. And bars. So maybe in 8 bars, Every bars, you'll have a little bit different mix-up, even four bars. So that's what I came up with. Let's see. So like that, you know? So very nice. Yeah, that's some stuff I could never do. But I did, modify a lot, added some of my own bits and stuff like that. I'm not set up to do full MIDI drums because I don't have a MIDI drum kit anymore. So everything I have to do is by hand and or modification. So I knew I wanted to go with that. And so I started working on some bass lines. Like I said, these things go through a lot of different changes. Let's see, hear this miserable mess. Pretty much knew I wanted that to be the I'm not very good at it. I knew that I wanted that I need my bass here to be the to be a part of this song, even though it didn't really sound very Mexican or surf. But I knew I wanted that to be that type of progression. I thought was more in line with the new Mexican surf music, although it's not really something that the bass would do. But I knew that I wanted to do that because it was hard. It was hard for me to play, even though it sounds quite easy. Let me get that in again. I got to get these drums out of here. They're just too overpowering. Okay, let's see. So, as you can see, I don't really know what I'm playing. I'm just practicing. I'm trying to put some things down to flesh out the song. And I'm going in a pretty bad direction, I think. My fingers just cramped up. So, remember, these are things I'm not used to playing. It's riffs I've never played before or even thought of. Let me get my bass. All right, I feel better. So I probably can't even play it because I haven't played it since I played that. But let's see. So it starts here. So this is the riff. And, that doesn't seem too hard. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But it gets harder when you try to think it out of that 3 going into 4. So... And then, I put the going up. I put a little bit of try to put a little bit of disco when I go down. And then I get. And then do the second one. And I sort of stop there. And then I did this little. Knew I wanted to work that in. I don't know why. That's how the bass works. And let's hear. Sometimes I don't know why I think that this is going to be interesting, but let's hear how I think this might have been the first attempt at the regular verse. See, I'm trying to... So I'm trying to think of, country goes like that... I don't even know what I'm playing. I'm all noisy. Oh, Jesus. That's how it goes. And I think that's how country goes. I'm not sure. So somehow I equated country coming from blues and probably maybe some Mexican influence as well. But then I was wrong. So... Then it hit me like, okay, it won't progress like this, and it won't progress like this, but maybe it will. So I went backwards, and then it was all making sense. Let's see how I blow this one. Like I said, once again, just trying to figure things out here. Flesh It Out. Which just would have made a horrible song. That's right. Yeah, I was going. But then I ended up just changing that there. Vinny Morin. Vinny Morin. As I blow it. So instead of going. So that's how I came up with the song, and now I will play it at the end of the show. That's how it all came about. I don't think there's any other part of the story that really needs to be told at this point. That sounds good. Wow, I don't know what's going on there. Wow, I know what it is. I forgot to mute all these. All right. In other Chikara theme songs, I also used to like to try to work in bits of songs I love. Mostly like that type of thing. But I didn't work that into this one. And even in the one Chikara song, I even like work in that little rush thing that... Which is like, Rush is like, oh, that's what it is. I don't even remember how Rush goes. There it is. I stink. Anyway, I like to play the bass. Oh, look at me. Oh, baby. So I came up with that and tried not to add any elements of other things that I admire. Tried to make it completely original. And the best parts of the song, when I had a chop it down to 23 seconds or so, 23 or 30 seconds, it was too long. So the best parts of it, which in my opinion are like the setup, had to get knocked off, which and also give the most Latin feel, in my opinion. So I was, you know, pretty proud of it. I know it's not completely original. If it sounds like something that might come out of Mexican surf rock, then I realize that it probably has all been done before, because there's not too many ways to play 50s and 60s music. In fact, when I was trying to write it, I somehow wrote Louie Louie or something came out of my... It's just what my hands naturally did. It's not something that I never played Louie Louie before, but somehow I was noodling around and thinking of a certain feel to the song, and Louie Louie came out. Well, my friend at work then told me that this is La Bamba start. He said the La Bamba start. So that whole La Bamba start had to get cut. Now, I haven't listened to La Bamba since he mentioned that. Let me see. I'm going to look it up here. La Bamba. Okay. And we're both going to listen to this together to hear how my song is La Bamba. And I had to wait all this. I wrote this in 2001. And that's the saddest thing. It's my newest song, and it's already a year, from a year ago in name only. Let's hear it. Ready? Let's see what we got here. Oh, okay. Okay, so that's quite different and quite a lot better than what I do, actually. Boy, I don't like to hear real music next to my music. It makes me realize that I'm very simplistic. But I did tell you what, it all comes out of me, you know. That really shows that I wasn't trying to ape something else. Unfortunately, I guess I should have. And, I made the song, and that's how it came out. Now, what I mentioned about the organ, let's just see. This is very, very simple stuff here. Let's see. Get it up here. Just same riff over and over. That's with the guitar in it. There you go. So that's it. It just happens over and over. And that's the jazz part. The asshole jazz. Not asshole, just beatnik. And you might have even heard that riff somewhere else. And I think that's it. I do a couple false breaks. I try to make it interesting all the way through. A little bit of modern things, a little bit of electronic things happening in and out of it. But mostly just guitar and bass. And those little organ riffs. But I tried to stay with that. And it was an interesting departure for me to do and play and just to create. So I'm very happy. Very happy with how it came out. I was very pleased with it. And although I'm sure it's not exactly what Mike would have wanted, but that's what he got. So friends, I gotta get out of here because now I just knew what it would happen to do. I hope that you like me, and I hope that was interesting in some way. Oh, look what my mom sent me. She sent me this because she wants me to want to keep the God in the Pledge of Allegiance of the United States of America, but didn't realize, I guess, that it sort of exposes its the underbelly of it. It says, official versions, changes in bold italics. This is a chain letter sent out if you want to keep the God in our Pledge of Allegiance for the United States of America. Now, in 1892, I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. In 1892 to 1923, it says, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands. They added the word to. One nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. 1923 to 1924, they changed it to, I pledge allegiance to the flag, not my flag, to the flag of the United States and to the republic for which it stands. One nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. 1924 to 1954, they changed it to, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. 1954 to present, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all. They don't mention why the under God was put in there to separate us in 1954 in the Cold War from the heathenistic Russians, the Rushkis. But it's interesting that they even, they admit to this being a modern addition, addendum, if you will, to something that they otherwise are trying to tell you that it's based on the birth of our Christian nation, of our first love, and yet they'll rightly admit to it that it was rather recently that was added. Let us end now a Wiggly World on a poem, of course. Why not end with some Wiggly poetry? Most likely a song will follow from here in some fashion or another, but since I completely buried this and forgotten about it until this, and your letters are here and I forgot about those, but it's far too much at this point. So here goes, good luck. If you take me out of the equation, how different would it be to get back where you are? For no future to see within me appears real, surely true if revealed what was concealed. When the coldest day of my life read aloud, my mind and my heart cracked from what disavowed, my lap grew cold. Can I crack that shallow? Will there be more abstract to follow? What lies beneath the facade, a humble, tearful, quivering child, and all the while, confounding it all, forgetting the dance is just shaping a fall. And now, in weeping eyes, I removed that part of me. And now, with stronger hands, I lift that part of me. I taste the bitter from the heart of me, but when exposed, there is no real me. Yada, 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 maybe something about salt, another few verses, and a hook, and a poop-poop-be-doo. That's all I wrote, friends. That's all I got. Hey, I'm going to end you with a song. It's called Chikara Theme 2011, which is sad that I named it that, because now it's 2012, and the song seems old. It's called Chikara Theme 2011 by Wiggly of Trapdoor. And fun fact, he probably thought it sounded pretty good when he recorded it. Friends, I'm Wiggly. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. I hope I can get back on here again, but I doubt it, and I think this is my last show. So I love you all. Thank you very much. I hope that you like me. Bye-bye.
That we are all Wiggly. This physical world is Wiggly. And this is the most important thing to realize about it. As I've sometimes said, we're living in the middle of a Rorschach plot. And there really is no way that the physical world is. In other words, the nature of truth, I said in the beginning, somebody had said that thoughts were made to conceal truth. This is the fact, because there is no such thing as the truth that can be stated. In other words, ask the question, what is the true position of the stars in the Big Dipper? Well, it depends where you're looking at them from. And there is no absolute position. So in the same way, accountants, a good accountant will tell you that any balance sheet is simply a matter of opinion. There's no such thing as a true state of affairs of a business. But we're all hooked on the idea that there is, you see, an external objective world, which is a certain way. And that there, it really is that way. History, for example, is a matter of opinion. History is an art, not a science. It's something constructed, which is accepted as a more or less satisfactory explanation of events, which, as a matter of fact, don't have an explanation at all. Most of what happens in history is completely irrational. But people always have to feel that they've got to find a meaning. For example, you get sick, and you've lived a very good life, And you've been helpful to other people and done all sorts of nice things. And you get cancer. And you say to the clergyman, why did this have to happen to me? And you're looking for an explanation, and there isn't one. It just happened that way. But people feel if they can't find an explanation, they feel very, very insecure. Why? Because they haven't been able to straighten things out. The world is not that way. So the truth, in other words, what is going on, is of course a lot of wiggles. But the way it is always in relation to the way you are. In other words, however hard I hit a skinless drum, it will make no noise. Because noise is a relationship between a fist and a skin. So in exactly the same way, light is a relationship between electrical energy and eyeballs. It is you, in other words, who evoke the world, and you evoke the world in accordance with what kind of a you are, what kind of an organism. One organism evokes one world, another organism evokes another world. And so everything, reality is a kind of relationship. So once one gets rid of the idea of the truth as some way the world is in a fixed sense, say, it is that way. See? Then you get to another idea of the truth altogether. The idea, the truth that cannot be stated, the truth that cannot be pinned down.